morning. Thank you for the opportunity to offer some reflection. The only reason they asked me to give a talk is because I turned up before the really big advent. It's nice to be here, see friends. Thinking, coming back to Wat Nanachat, which is a large training monastery, thinking about the training and the excellent opportunity, particularly that those who live here and commit to keeping 8 precepts, 10 precepts, or the precepts of the bhikkhu, that opportunity and what that opportunity is and how the various factors of that training work. And I remember coming as a bhikkhu, as a layman and becoming a bhikkhu and feeling quite baffled about how it works, or would it work, does it work, lots of doubts, lots of restlessness. And now 17, 18 years into the life, reviewing and seeing that in some respects it does work, depending on our spiritual, accumulated spiritual qualities from the past, and also depending on how diligent we are. We're just kind of seeing what an excellent situation, what an excellent container it is for training the mind. And so you have this precepts, they're unnegotiable. When we come to a monastery, that's the standard everybody has to keep, a very high level of sila. And so this sila is giving the mind an integrity, a foundation. It's, to think in terms of a metaphor, it's like, I sometimes think of the mind being like a field or like soil. And if you break the precepts, you don't take care of your sila, it's like there's too much fire element. The sun bakes that earth and it becomes hard and cracked. And the seeds, that we all have seeds, seeds of potential in our minds. And those seeds get blown away by the worldly dhammas, or too much reactivity. But when we keep the sila, it's as if that earth element is brought more into balance, and there's some moisture in that soil, and the soil can become soft, and those seeds with other elements can sprout and grow. And so we have this foundation of, there's more lay people listening to this talk than monks and bhikkhus, but it's the same training, sila samadhi bhavana. This sila is, or should be, unnegotiable. It really is incredibly important, and it's one of those things that you can only know after you've kept it very strictly for a period of time. You look back and you overview and you see what was the result of keeping the precepts, and you see that the mind has an integrity. So this three root kilesas that we all struggle with, the greed, hatred and the delusion, is the keeping the sila that gives the mind some clarity and some power to be able to recognize these things and reflect on these things, and in a way to begin to defend against them or protect the mind from their harmful influence, and start to recognize what is delusion and to start to weaken it and uproot it, and hopefully to have insights into the truth. And so monasteries, and those of us who have the good fortune to be able to live in them, we have this very solid and very powerful foundation of sila. On top of that, we have making time to meditate structured into the training, into the monastic life, and this is incredibly helpful because it's that training in meditation objects, keeping meditation objects in mind, that strengthens the sati. And moments of samadhi in the beginning, some people have more samadhi, some people have less, but it, as Ajahn Chah trains us, it's through maintaining good mindfulness consistently that sama samadhi arises in moments, and then later for periods of time, and then hopefully we all develop quite a bit of samadhi as we continue to train. And that samadhi giving the sati, the mindfulness, even more power, and giving the wise reflection more power, so that we develop the capacity to reflect upon our experience. One, to recognize our experience with mindfulness and clear comprehension, and then to be able to reflect around it so that Ajahn Chah is saying it's very important to keep the mind in the middle, not to fall into liking and disliking. This is based on pleasant feelings and unpleasant feelings, and we need to recognize a pleasant feeling. We need to know that that's occurring, and then we notice the attachment. And then you need a lot of mindfulness to train, keeping the mind in the middle, practicing the middle way, which is keeping things balanced and keeping the mind in its natural, normal state. So those of us who are monastics have a great opportunity with a lot of support to help that occur. And then there's other factors to this training. There's the fact that we can't just meditate all day, that you have to go an arms round and you have to come to meetings and have to come and listen to talks. There's all sorts of things that you have to do that you might not do if you had the choice just to be at your kuti. And this is actually helpful, and we don't understand this in the beginning, because it's this living in a container where you do a certain amount of meditation and you have this foundation of very good sila, and then you get to experience your mind when you're having to do things that you don't want to do, but you're experiencing it with mindfulness, hopefully. And what happens is you get to train, don't we? You all get to train with letting go. Ajahn Chah says so much of practice is learning how to let go. And so we get to train, don't we? Our reactions coming up, something we don't want to do, we just surrender, we just do it. That's the form, that's the training, that's a monastic requirement, we do it. And we learn something about the peace that comes from letting go of kilesa, which is different from the peace that comes from suppressing them, or the peace that comes from samatha. Samatha plays an enormously important role. But in terms of the five spiritual powers, which the Buddha said, when cultivated and in harmony, if they're all powerful, lead to the deathless. So we can't just practice samatha. You need to see your greed, and you need to see your hatred, you need to see your liking and your not liking. And Ajahn Chah explains to us that the place where the suffering is the place where the suffering ceases. And it's this getting up and doing some meditation and then having to go on arms round, or having to sweep leaves, or having to listen to a Dhamma talk, that you have enough clarity to be able to see your mind, the liking and the disliking. And Ajahn Chah also instructs us that with regards to our suffering, which we all have a lot of, to make big suffering into small suffering as a training, and to make small suffering into no suffering. So that requires this letting go. Ajahn Chah says is fundamentally important in our training, is to recognize unwholesome dhammas and to be able to let go of them. And so if you continue in this training, you actually become capable of doing that, whereas in the beginning you might turn up and there's a lot of irritation, a lot of aversion, a lot of doubts, and then for many of us a lot of believing our opinions that it shouldn't be the way it is and that it should be otherwise. But with this foundation of a commitment, another really wonderful aspect to the Ajahn Chah training that we've trained with is that sense of a longer term commitment, that at Wat Nanachat you become a bhikkhu with a commitment of 5 years. And that's difficult to find in this day and age, people who can make that kind of commitment to something which isn't short term. But this is it's part of the container, this making this commitment, because basically we don't understand how the very sophisticated training of the Buddha and Ajahn Chah's core what. There's a lot of very sophisticated factors which work together as a package that we don't know in the beginning how it works. But it's through commitment and faith and a great deal of patient endurance that you see, after a period of years, you are more capable of recognizing wholesome mind states, unwholesome mind states. You're more capable of seeing your own mind, having a more of a reflective faculty, and you get more skill at letting go of the things that make you suffer. So that's really wonderful. Recently, I was in India. I had the opportunity to lead a pilgrimage for the first time. There are many people involved in building monasteries. It's a huge amount of people offer various resources to build a monastery. And so some of those people who've been helping me, coming up to almost 3 years now, of Anandagiri, Kalkor, Petchabun, And some people have really given a lot to help this monastery blossom, come into being. And so some of those people asked me if I would consider leading a pilgrimage in India. And I thought that would be a good thing to do, because for lay people, going on a pilgrimage, it's an excellent opportunity to really leave your busy and complex life behind. And going to a place like India, it's so different to, sometimes I think going to India, it's not like going to another country, it's like going to another planet. And there's a real value to doing that, because you have permission to put your ordinary life down, because it's not valid, it's not relevant, there's no frame of reference. You have to deal with India, which is so in your face, and there's a real value to doing that. And so it was wonderful to be able to lead a group of Kalyanamitta, good, sincere lay people who have helped a lot. It was really nice to share some experience and help them to leave their lives. And we didn't do it, it wasn't a quick pilgrimage, it was 16 days, it was a nice pace, and there was a lot of time to practice. And all of those lay people did experience deeper peace than they usually do in those various holy sites, and more rapture. And as is often the case with pilgrimages, people come back from pilgrimage and they have more faith. And this is very important, because a strong faith faculty, the next of the spiritual powers, energy. We need energy to put forth effort. And so if you have strong faith, the energy's there. And then you have the energy, then you can put forth the effort. Cultivate the mindfulness, the concentration, and keep reflecting, developing the wisdom. So it's really nice to help people to have that experience and to make the merit and come back and practice a bit harder. Another thing that I found out recently is that my father has lung cancer. And so I was wondering, what should I do? Should I go and visit him? He's 2 weeks into 1 month of radiation treatment now for lung cancer. And it occurred to me, I have 5 brothers and sisters, and it occurred to me that they're doing their bit, making sure Dad gets through the appointments and whatnot. And it occurred to me that probably the best thing I could do is offer my practice. And so a few friends helped me to stay on an extra week in Sarnath and an extra 3 weeks in Bodh Gaya. And as a new abbot, there's a lot of things to think about, and not just being an abbot, but also building the actual place. You learn a lot about buildings, and you have to pay attention to all sorts of things. This phenomena of having to be responsible, people expecting you to be responsible. And if you are responsible, then you make a certain amount of barami. And if you are not responsible, then it's the opposite. You probably make bad karma. And so there's this sense of, I have to be responsible, I have to. And so it's really nice to put that down. It's really nice to have a break from that and just practice. And I thought, oh, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stay here in India and I'm going to meditate a lot. And I'm going to offer the merit of that. I do have strong faith in merit. And I do believe, as Buddha explains, that the merit that comes from bhavana is superior or more potent, more powerful. And so what I'm going to do for my dad is I'm going to generate punya as much as I can and dedicate it to him repeatedly throughout the day. And so another wonderful thing about practicing in holy sites, and by the way, I think we can consider Wat Nong Phapong as a holy site, since we're all here, the Ajahn Chah gathering, and those relics of Ajahn Chah there, and very special quality of in the air, energy. It was probably the place where Thanajan Chah became an arahant. It's a very special place, and his relics are there as well. And large numbers of monks practicing very well for a long time. So the thing about practicing in holy sites is that there's extra spiritual energy, and sometimes you find that you're able to do more practice than you would otherwise. And so for myself, I find it not that difficult to meditate for 7, 8, 9, sometimes even 10 hours at one a day, and consistently day after day at the holy sites. And so it was wonderful. I was able to do a lot of meditation, dedicate the merit to my dad. But the point of what I want to say now is coming back to the monastery and discovering that over the various couple of bathrooms are being renovated because they leaked, and there's a couple of new bathrooms also, and to discover that 4 out of 6 bathrooms have this interesting phenomena where the water doesn't go down the drain hole. and then how that affects the mind. And coming from India, and you realize it's like sitting facing the wall of the Mahabodhi temple for 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day and practicing with physical pain or cold weather or beautiful pujas 1 second and Indians arguing 1 meter behind you the next second, and just the stuff that you have to practice with, yeah, is actually fairly easy because you've got this nice wall and you just have to sit there and you don't have to relate to people. And also kind of the perspective that one has about one's good fortune when you're in a place like Bihar, so many poor people, and you feel very easy to feel grateful. You feel so grateful, you feel so blessed. When you look at these beggars who are sitting on the dirt and the dust and the rocks and looking at a drain and people spitting as they walk past and the tuk-tuks rushing past and they're just sitting in this cloud of dust and most people ignoring them, but every now and then somebody giving them something, and they just have the one set of clothes and one shawl and they sleep in that same place, and you look at that and you think, oh my goodness. And it's easy to feel very grateful, and you come back and you feel grateful, and then, but then this challenging phenomena of what do you do with this phenomena of a builder who's being paid very well to make a bathroom that should, in italics, work, and four of the bathrooms, the water doesn't go down the hole. And so it's really challenging because as monks, our standard is supposed to be we're content to have the root of a tree as our dwelling. And you come from India and you realize, wow, just even to have these robes and this food, we're so lucky. And there's this kind of, you have to wrestle with, should I say something, shouldn't I say something, should I be content with the puddle in the bathroom? And I had to check, I'm checking the perspective with the monks, and I'm checking with the guy that does the gardening in the monastery, and I asked him, well, what do you think? And he said, well, you know, it's the lay people's money, and they want the monastery to have good bathrooms, and they're paid a lot. So because they've paid for a quality product, he should deliver a quality product. So I have to kind of work up the energy to go and tell him, you have to do this again. And I don't like having to say that kind of thing, but I did say it. But it's like the point of this slight detour here is that, you know, samatha isn't going to work in that context. This is where we need our capacity to reflect and our capacity to see things in perspective and context. And then when one could be irritated and angry, well, not to come from that. You know, this is one of the things about training. With a whole training, we have the vinaya, and then we can reflect on our emotions. And oftentimes you just don't say something yet until you know how to say it or what to say. And so this is one of the wonderful things about training. It's like, you know, you have to say something, but you don't have to say it right now. Wait a couple of days. Think about the right way to say it. This is much more difficult for lay people because life is busier, and monks, our life's more spacious, and we can take time. And so I can just tell the guy really calmly, which I did, you have to redo this, and the water has to go down the hole before you get the final payment. But I remember thinking, oh, it's so much easier to face the wall of the Mahabodhi temple and meditate 10 hours a day. After you've been meditating for a couple of decades, you develop some meditation skills, and it's not that. And it's in a place which has more spiritual energy, you can deal with your hindrances, you can work with a bit of pain. But this dealing with the human realm gives us an opportunity to see our mind, see our reactivity, and practice the middle way. And there's a lot of there's a lot to be learnt by the impingement in the human realm and of relationship. And a large part of Ajahn Chah's training as well was that he didn't let us stay in our kutis all day. He did require that we come out and clean the sala, sweep the leaves, wash our robes on a certain day at the same time. And so he required that we train in harmony and learn to live in harmony, but he also required that we experience the impingement of living in community. And that has a very important function because we see our greed, we see our aversion. And the other thing about monastic life is the routine, that you get, you know, basically you will know, I tend to like this part of the day and I tend not to like this part of the day. I tend to not like one prayer, or I really don't like the day after one prayer. And you get to see, I'm likely to react about this thing on this occasion, either for grasping or grasping for, or grasping not for, liking and aversion. And so you get to anticipate what your likely reaction is going to be, and you get to practice with it. And this is an incredible opportunity, is that living within a container where you have some sense for what you're going to have to practice with. And then this whole realm of exploring and cultivating what's called kusala upaya, wholesome means, skillful means, you're basically learning how to train your mind. But one thing which is fundamentally important for all of us is not to blame others for our suffering, and not to blame the routine for our suffering, and not to blame the weather for our suffering, or the sound of the cars on the highway, or the sound of the planes, or whatever. So much of our practice is not doing that. As Ajahn Chah says, the place where the suffering is, that is the place where the suffering stops. It's not about making the outside different. It's about seeing where the reaction is, keeping the mind in the middle, not reacting, or if there is a reaction, letting it go. And so many things in this life are important. So the Sangha harmony is important, keeping the schedule is important, but then the meditation is important as well, because that's what supports the clarity that you need to bring to training. And so one thing I think we all need to do as well is take refuge in effort, and this is difficult because often we're tired, and one thing I've learned building a monastery is more work, more issues, and more exhaustion. And one thing I've learned about when things get really difficult, as they have, I don't need to go into details, but there's been a couple of periods in these 3 years that were really difficult, the most difficult periods of my life. And that's not an uncommon experience for new abbots. And what I learned is that when things get difficult, put forth more effort doing more good things. That's what gets you through difficult periods. And the four great efforts. And then it's like, the result of the good efforts, if you just keep doing good things, you take refuge in doing good, avoiding harm, purifying the mind. When things get difficult, find something wholesome to do and do it really well as best as you can. And you might find that you can get through a difficult patch and that the merit that you produce supports you so that you keep going. And so it's so tempting, isn't it, to rush back after Bindaban and have a half an hour nap if you can. Or to get back after the meal and you know you should do Jonkrom, but maybe you ate too much sticky rice and have a nap first. So this doesn't work. Having a nap whenever we can get one actually doesn't work. Well, you might find that if you do your half an hour of Jonkrom before the nap, you know, you'll be in a much better mood in the afternoon and your meditation will go better. And we just have to do this. This is another thing monastic training forces us to do, is to work through our hindrances. We can't sleep quite as much as we want to. We can't eat as slowly as we'd like to, all sorts of things. And the result is you can have periods where you just feel really tired. But if you put forth an effort, even then, you end up with this capacity to go against the kilesa and the laziness and end up with a powerful practice. So I'm hoping that something I've said might be helpful for training in this context, and I hope it was, some of it was helpful to lay people. Mostly it was aimed at the monastics, but thank you for the opportunity, and may we all grow in Dhamma.